Four. Okay. How's the sound? All right. Okay, now we got it. Thank you. Well, I just completed a marathon trip. I was throughout the state of Texas for the last 12 days. Got back very late last night. And, it was a very intense trip. And I was thinking as I was getting ready to get on the plane, okay, I'm done. I just need to relax and just try to recover so I can teach this class this morning. But you know, the Lord always has his ways. So I'm sitting in the airport in Austin, Texas, and this woman, probably in her early 30s, comes up to me and says, could you please take care of all my luggage? And it's happened to me several times in the airport, but my wife's comment is, I'm the only person where that ever happens to. And I've actually had people come up to me and say, will you please take care of my children while I... So, yeah, one time I had four little kids I was taking care of, while the parents ran off and did their thing. And I kept wondering, are they going to come back? I mean, I got two sons already. I'm not sure I want four more. But they came back. But no, she had me take care of her luggage, and she came back about 10 minutes later. And she saw my computer screen open and then said, oh, were you part of the conference? And I said, well, I was at a conference in Houston. Is that the one you're talking about? She said, no, I'm talking about the psychology research conference that was here in Austin. I said, no, I wasn't a part of that. And she said, well, tell me about your conference. So... And that began the conversation. And she says, oh, you study astrophysics and you believe in God? And I believe in God too, but I believe all the religions are basically following the same God. So she was a universalist. So I asked her, well, what makes you think that all religions are going to... I mean, I asked her if she believed in heaven. She said, yes, I believe in God. I believe everybody's going there. I says, well, how do you... draw that conclusion? She says, well, the golden rule. I says, well, have you ever thought about why every religion teaches the golden rule? And she says, no, I really haven't. What do you think about it? And I says, well, it tells us in the New Testament that God has written his law in the heart of every human being. And, you know, on that basis, you would expect every religion to basically own up to that law that's written in the heart of every human being. She says, well, I've never thought about that. So he says, can I ask you some more questions? Well, I had a chance just to lay the gospel out for her and explain to her why, because, you know, she's really into science, and asked her, you know, okay, how do you make sense of science? Can you make sense of science from a Hindu worldview perspective? Explained to her why that doesn't work. Or I said, from an Islamic perspective or even a Jewish perspective. And she said, can I get your card? So I gave her a card and said, what am I going to find in your website? And she basically walked away saying, I'm going to be spending at least a couple of hours tonight on your website and want to know what book I should, that I've written that she should read first. So then we get on the airplane. I mean, she was going somewhere else, so I got on the airplane. And I love these airplanes where, you know, there's only 72 seats, two here and two across, where the jets are at the back. It's quiet enough you can actually have decent conversations on the plane. So I got my computer open, and a guy on the other side of me was an engineer. Interesting, everybody I talked to either had a PhD or was on the verge of getting a PhD. And again, what are the odds that the only people I would talk to are academics, okay? So, anyway, he was an engineer, and he was looking over at my screen and said, I'm seeing that you're writing about planets outside the solar system. I said, what are you working on? I said, well, I'm doing the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, and I'm going to be adding a new section on exoplanets, because we knew very little about exoplanets when the third edition came out. So he says, well, I'm really curious about what you wrote there about how we've discovered all these planets, but none are like the planets in our solar system. He says, is that really true? Because, you know, NASA keeps talking about Earth-like planets. I was able to explain to him, yeah, but what NASA means by Earth-like is whether there's a possibility they might have liquid water on their surface. He says, you're not impressed by that? And I says, well, I'm an astronomer. I know the third most abundant molecule in the universe is water, right after hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3. I says, the universe is soaking wet, so, you know, you'd expect to find a lot of water in a lot of places. You know, it's unusual. Most of it's frozen or gaseous. But yeah, you're going to find places where you're going to have some liquid water. But I said, there's more than just the liquid water habitable zone. He said, well, how many are there? And I said, well, they discovered 9 so far, and I think they're on the verge of getting a 10th. I might be writing about that soon. So he said, tell me about these 9. So I told him about the 9, and he says, you know, there's only one planet that ever could possibly be in all 9 at the same time. They're not going to find any. So then he asked me a final question. He says, what planet places second for being in the most habitable zones? I said, well, they think they have found one that is in 3 of the zones, but missing the other 6. And he says, well, if you miss the 6, you've missed them. You just can't have life. And he said, can I have a card? So I gave him a card. He said, which book should I read first? I told him about the different books. He says, I'm going to buy Improbable Planet. So that's the book he's going to get, because he really wants to know about these planets. Not a believer. None of the people I talked to are believers. But he says, I'm really interested in this stuff. I've been talking to Christians, and they know nothing about science and faith. So I'm so glad to meet you. And then the fellow was sitting beside me said, can I have a card too? So, yeah.
Do you think NASA is intentionally deceptive in the way they word that Earth-like planets, or is that just scientists speaking to each other and they're not thinking about it?
Well, both the gentlemen on either side of me on the aircraft asked me that question, you know, what do we do with these NASA announcements? And I said, well, keep in mind NASA's dependent on public funding. And, you know, they get a big sum of money from the government. They want more, of course. But I said, one way they're trying to sustain their giving is by saying, you keep sending your tax dollars to us, we're going to find life elsewhere in the universe. That's their mission. And so on that basis, it's not surprising that they keep pumping in their public announcements that we're on the verge of finding life elsewhere. Well, I've spoken to a number of NASA institutions saying, eventually the public's going to get tired of you crying wolf all the time. And that could impact your funding. Why not really pump the stuff that is exciting? Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. About a month ago, they found this star with 7 planets orbiting it, TRAPPIST-1. And NASA put a huge public release. All 7 might be habitable planets. And, you know, what I've been doing on my Facebook and Twitter page is saying to the public, whenever you see a web article like that, see if they give you a link to the peer-reviewed paper. If they don't give you a link, probably you shouldn't read it. A good article, a good web article will always give you the link to the source where you can read for yourself. And there are a couple of papers or web articles on TRAPPIST-1 where they actually did give you a link to the peer-reviewed paper. If you read the peer-reviewed paper, what was really exciting is this star is close enough to us and the planets are close enough to the star, we have a good chance of actually determining the chemistry of the atmospheres on these planets. Now, as an astronomer, that's exciting. So kind of what I've been telling the NASA, why don't you publish the real story? And so we don't think the public's going to get excited about the chemistry of atmospheres, but they're going to get excited about life. But for me, learning about the atmospheres of these other planets is exciting in the sense that it's going to show us how amazingly designed the chemistry of our atmosphere is, and that's something the public can get excited about. Because that's something we've been discovering, just how amazing the chemistry and how unique the chemistry of a planet Earth. Let me give you an example. The Earth-like planets that we're finding outside the solar system, their atmospheres typically have 1,200 times as much carbon and 2,400 times as much nitrogen. So our atmosphere is extremely carbon poor and extremely nitrogen poor. And if we had that norm of nitrogen, and that's something you'd expect. Nitrogen and carbon are abundant in the universe. So you'd expect that Earth-like planets would have, you know, really thick atmospheres of carbon and nitrogen. But if that's the case, there's no possibility for life on that planet. The amount of heat that would be absorbed from the star to the surface of the planet would be extremely hot and also unstable. And it would not be conducive for the origin of life. So in that sense, I would be really excited about TRAPPIST-1. And that's what the peer-reviewed paper was all about. It wasn't about so much that, hey, it's in the water habitable zone. I did mention it, but in a very low-keyed way, whereas NASA really hyped that up. And, you know, when the paper came out, I said, oh, this star is incredibly dim. It's as dim as it could be and still be a star. And I also noted it was young. I mean, it's less than a billion years old. So I says, this has got to be a fast-rotating star. So I looked it up, and sure enough, it's a very fast-rotating star. Rotates once every 1.4 days. Our star is 25 to 30 days, depending what latitude you're at. And I knew that fast-rotating young stars pour out lots of X-ray and flaring radiation. And so I did a survey of the literature, and sure enough, there was a paper out of Britain. It wasn't published yet, but it was in preprint form, basically where they measured the star, and sure enough, it's pumping out lots of X-ray radiation. Well, that automatically makes all seven planets not habitable. The paper has since been published, so it's gotten through the peer review process. The other thing I notice is that the seven planets are all really close together. I mean, so close together that if you're on one of the planets, you'd be able to see the next planet just like we see the moon. They're that close together. And so they're that close together, their orbits have to be synchronous. And sure enough, if you dig deep enough into the literature, there's synchronous orbits. Now, they're synchronous orbits. What that means is that seven planets formed far away from the star and migrated in. The very process of migration will strip it of all of its water. It probably had a lot of water, but as it moved in towards the star, they all became bone dry. And I wound up doing, by the way, whenever NASA makes a big hype like this, I get a bunch of interviews. So in that sense, I want NASA to keep hyping these articles. I mean, I got 11 interviews on TRAPPIST-1, amazing. But the gist of the interviews was, you know, in terms of habitability, I mean, virtually every strike against these planets is there in the case of TRAPPIST-1. It's about the least likely habitable planet that NASA could have picked. But yeah, I'm making a living on NASA hyping all their discoveries, so I really shouldn't be complaining. But I'm using it as an opportunity to train people. Whenever you see a big announcement like that, look for the link to the paper. And people say, well, I can't read the technical literature. Here's a cue. This is practiced throughout the scientific community, namely that the abstracts of the papers are available to the public free of charge. Yeah, they charge you for the paper. You'll pay like $25 to $40 to read the paper. But the abstracts are always free, and they're always accessible to the public. And typically the abstract gives you the bottom line. They tend to take out the technical details and give you the bottom line. So I'm basically telling lay people, don't be intimidated by these papers. Read the abstract, and that's probably good enough. If you want the technical details, ask us, and we'll tell you. Yeah?
I have a question and a comment. First of all, and please don't answer this until I make my comment, but you mentioned about how those exoplanets will eventually go into their star, their sun. Will our Earth eventually do that, or is it that our sun will burn out before that? And then another comment. I mean, another. You know me. I like to comment. I also believe in providential circumstances. This morning, I was just really realizing how much of an influence one man could have on this world. And I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I'm saying good things. You know, I think it was Wesley won 1/3 of England to the Lord through the Holy Spirit. And I think you're a great example to us. Granted, you're unusually brilliant, but we can't use that as an excuse if we're not unusually brilliant. You know, we can still have an influence on this world the way you have, and praise God for you. But can you answer my question?
Okay.
Remember? See, will our Earth eventually go into the sun, or will the sun extinguish before the sun?
Right.
Or do we know?
Yeah, our Earth is not going to migrate in towards the sun. That will not happen. Yeah. On the other hand, as the sun gets older and older, it will get brighter and brighter. And eventually, when it stops burning hydrogen to helium, it's going to expand in size. And will expand in size to a sufficient degree that it will turn our planet into a charcoal briquette.
There we go.
Yeah, we will be incinerated by the future physics of the sun.
In a few million years or something, right?
It won't be a few million years. It's going to take a little more than 4 billion years before we get incinerated. So hopefully we will fulfill the Great Commission before those 4 billion years run out. Yes.
When you say that, are you? Is that in relation to like 2 Peter?
Well, 2 Peter, and you'll see it repeated also in Isaiah, talks about a future time when God will roll up the universe like a scroll and it'll disappear in a fiery heat. Okay. A number of Hebrew scholars or Greek scholars have said that's a metaphor for kind of how God's going to transition things. But there are a number of astronomers who think that could literally be fulfilled exactly as it's stated. And it's referred to as the ekpyrotic Big Bang creation model, which basically... Okay, let me...
I need the Holy Spirit.
All right. Okay, well, the ekpyrotic is a Greek word which means out of fire, which is basically saying in the Big Bang model, the universe starts off infinitesimally small and infinitely hot. So it starts off extremely hot. And as it expands, it gets colder and colder and colder. That's the Big Bang model. But one version of the Big Bang model says that we know the universe has 10 dimensions, length, width, height, and time, and 6 very tiny space dimensions. And our best measurements of the geometry of the universe tell us it's flat. It's flat to almost 4 places of the decimal. So we're looking at a flat 10-dimensional sheet. Now, it's not like a sheet of paper, because this only has, say, 2 dimensions. Okay? So don't try to visualize it. You can't. But it's basically meaning there's no curvature to the universe. It's not saddle-shaped. It's not spherically shaped. It's kind of like this sheet of paper. Okay. Let me use these 2 dimensions as an analogy for the 10-dimensional universe. We're kind of sitting here in the 10-dimensional flat universe, and we can only look as far away as the look-back time to creation. Keep in mind, we look at the universe, we're seeing the universe as it was in the past, because it takes light time to travel to us. So the universe that actually exists today is much bigger than the universe we see through the telescope. Because the universe is expanding. And the universe we see through the telescope is the universe of the past. And the farther away we look, the farther back in time we see. Well, astronomers have said, okay, that means that here's this 10-dimensional flat universe, but we're only able to see this much of it in terms of the present era. They said there's the possibility, if we go far enough out in the sheet, that instead of it remaining flat like we observe, it actually curls and does something like this. And so it still looks flat everywhere we can see, but if we go far beyond where we can't see, it actually curls in on itself, and you actually have a 10-dimensional flat surface with a 10-dimensional flat surface of the same surface directly above us. Okay, and what they pointed out is that in quantum mechanics, this 10-dimensional surface is fluctuating. There's space-time fluctuations in this surface. And there's a possibility that a quantum space-time fluctuation on the bottom part of the 10-dimensional sheet will make contact with a quantum space-time fluctuation on the top sheet. If they were to connect with one another, the entire 10-dimensional sheet shrinks down into an infinitesimal volume, the universe disappears in a fiery heat, and it's gone. So, it's actually possible that 2 Peter could be fulfilled literally. It's also possible, it's a metaphor. The fact that we see it repeated 3 times in the Bible kind of encourages me that it's probably more likely to be literal than figurative. Okay?
2 Peter, Isaiah, you said 3 times?
Well, it's twice in Isaiah and once in 2 Peter. Yeah, you can check it out. Okay, so that's how the universe could come to an end. Now, as to whether it's going to be billions of years from now, what this model actually tells us goes one step further. They've actually calculated, okay, what if this disappearance of the universe were to happen, say, tomorrow? How close do the two parts of the sheet have to be to one another for you to have any reasonable possibility it could happen, say, sometime in the next few million years? The two parts of the sheet have to be about a millimeter apart from one another. So, you know, that's kind of mind-boggling to think of, that there could be a 10-dimensional sheet just 1 millimeter away from us in a dimension we can't probe or touch. So, but hey, God's like that. We can't see him, we can't touch him, but it tells us in the Bible he's physically closer to us than we are to one another, because he's in that dimensional realm, which gives us the confidence we can trust him. Okay, John, then I want to go back to what I wanted to talk about. Okay. Okay, as they're moving from the what's called the area where water is frozen, because, I mean, the planets that are soaking wet are those planets that are forming far enough away from the star where the water's frozen. And so they get all that. For example, two of the moons of Jupiter are more than 35% water. To give you a comparison, our planet Earth is 0.03%. The most Earth-like planets we're discovering outside the solar system come in at a minimum of 5% to a maximum of 50%. Now, that's why I'm not excited about these Earth-like planets. They can't be candidates, at least for advanced life, because there's no possibility to ever get continents. The oceans are so deep that you would never get continents. Incidentally, the primordial Earth was also in that state. We started off with a huge abundance of water. The primordial Earth had oceans that were thousands of miles deep. The moon-forming event stripped all the water from planet Earth, completely stripped our atmosphere. Remember it says in the Bible, there's darkness over the surface of the deep? The primordial Earth had an atmosphere so thick, no light could get through. But the moon-forming event eradicated our ocean and eradicated the atmosphere. And then comets brought a thin layer of water back to the Earth and a thin atmosphere. But that's what you need for advanced life. You need a...
Freeze,
pardon me?
When the waters freeze, if they're 1,000 miles deep and no light... Well,
you're on to something. One of the problems with planets that are water-rich, matter of fact, even if all you got is, like, say, 1% water instead of 5 to 50% water... If you got 1% water, the oceans will be deep enough that you get pressure at the bottom of the ocean that actually turns that water into ice. And now, you know, they tell you that the densest form of water is liquid water. That assumes not too high of a pressure. You get a high enough pressure. How deep do the oceans have to be before you actually get ice forming? About 50 miles deep. So none of our oceans are deep enough for that to happen. But it's a problem because if you get ice at the bottom of the oceans, that means there's no possibility of liquid water making contact with the silicate core or the silicate crust. And if that doesn't happen, there's no way you can pull greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere to compensate for the brightening of the star, which means if you've got light there, it's not there for very long. And so the only way you're going to have life existing, even microbes existing for a few million years or more, is if you got liquid water making contact with the silicates of the crust.
Okay, but liquid water could still exist without life really being visible on the surface of the planet?
You could have microbes in the liquid water on the surface, but it's not going to last long. Because eventually the star will bright, because all stars get brighter as they get older, and eventually the star will become too bright for that light to survive. So you got ephemeral life at best. Okay, I got off on the topic here. So, yeah. Back to the story of what happened on the airplane. The gentleman on my right, who I was sharing a two-row seat with, he said, "Can I have your card?" And then he said, well, you know, he's got a PhD in engineering. I'm going to be defending my thesis next week. And then once I get past my thesis defense, I'm going to be taking up an assistant professorship. I said, that's really rare. I've never heard of that happening, where a graduate student goes straight from, says, you've actually got a job promised to you, a tenure-track job in a university, and you haven't even passed your thesis defense yet. And they said, yep, I got it all sewed up, contracts written, etc. So I found out later why that all worked out. But then he said, yeah, my degree is in psychology. I'm really neuropsychology. And he's telling me about a bit about his research. And I was sharing with him, well, you know, I got a son who's pursuing a doctorate in neuroclinical psychology. And so we talked about that. But he says, I really want to talk to you about what you were sharing with the engineer. And, you know, this thing about planets. But you know, the thing that's really been getting to me is, you know, because I've been, he was going to Arizona University, and he said, I've been running into all these atheists. And he said, look, I believe in God, but I've been running into these atheists who've been talking about quantum gravity. Do you know anything about quantum gravity? And I said, well, I just finished writing the chapter in the fourth edition of The Creator of the Cosmos. Isn't this interesting? Here I am working on the, because, you know, I was on the road for 12 days, but my staff said, you got to write every minute you're down. So I was writing, and I got two chapters done. And one was on the exoplanets, and one was on the quantum gravity stuff. So he said, well, tell me, what did you write? And I said, well, he was talking about Sean Carroll. I don't know if any of you have heard of him. He's one of the leading atheists in this country. He's at Caltech. I got to share the platform with him at Caltech in 2008. You can actually watch, I think we got the DVD there where Sean Carroll comes up and joins me in fielding questions. He's an atheist, a brilliant physicist, and he's dedicated his life to trying to escape the space-time theorems. You've heard me speak on the space-time theorems before. You know, if the universe contains mass and if general relativity reliably describes the movements of bodies in the universe, then there must be a beginning to space and time, and there must be a causal agent beyond space and time. And now we know that even applies to the inflation era, which is what happens to the universe when it's a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. So it says everything we know about the universe screams it's got this beginning, and there must be a transcendent beginner. Sean Carroll has dedicated his life to saying, well, these space-time theorems really only prove that inflation has a beginning. I says, well, that takes you back to a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. I said, most people would consider that close enough to the beginning to be the beginning. And, you know, everything we can measure, so the earliest we can go back is to the inflation era. I mean, I can show you observations which actually allows us to measure the physics of the universe when it is 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. And Sean's point is, yeah, but we haven't got measurements that go earlier than that. And because we don't have measurements that go earlier than that, we're free to speculate. He's actually put that in print. And so he's developed what he's called the quantum eternity theorem, which is basically saying if we go back early enough, and you have to go back in the Big Bang model to when the universe is only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. That's a 10 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. So you're talking about a really early epoch. So if you go back that far, quantum mechanics now becomes as powerful as gravity in determining the dynamics of the universe. And so he says, in that case, we're free to speculate exotic quantum mechanics that allows us to escape the beginning of the universe. And he's actually published this theorem where he says, if we make the quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric of the universe, we call the frothiness of quantum space-time foam, if we make the frothiness big enough, then there's a way we can escape the beginning. Now, it's not really an escape. What he's basically saying, make it frothy enough, it's possible that the universe collapses down to a very tiny size and expands from that, and maybe in the future it could come back, and therefore the universe might be eternal. Or another way he's put it is, because people have reacted to that and say, it's not going to come back. It's going to continue expanding forever at a faster and faster rate. So he says, okay, I still got a way out. I can have the collapse of the universe back down to this very tiny volume in the quantum gravity era be so slow it's like eternity. So that's kind of where he's going. Okay. That's the status of affairs until about 2 months ago. And there's blog articles you'll see on our reasons.org website where I talk about these observations that were done just in the past few months. Because a number of astronomers have said, okay, here we got Sean Carroll speculating that there's this extreme frothiness in the quantum space-time foam. By the way, he needs it really frothy to make his model work. He says, if it's that frothy, then as a beam of light travels towards us from a distant quasar or blazar, that quantum space-time frothiness is going to progressively blur the image of the quasar or blazar. So the longer the light travel time, the blurrier the image will be. And the blurriness will be enhanced at short wavelengths. So, I mean, radio wavelengths won't be that blurry, but X-ray wavelengths, yeah, you're going to get a lot of blurriness. So what did astronomers do? They made observations of these quasars and blazars to see if they could see the blurriness. They don't. It's sharp. The images are perfectly sharp. What does that tell us? It's not very frothy. And then there's a Christian theoretical physicist named by Aaron Wall who published a paper very recently where he said, okay, what Sean Carroll is saying is that these space-time theorems are assuming classical general relativity. In other words, general relativity is not interrupted very much by quantum mechanics in this extremely early of the universe. So he was able to publish an extension of the space-time theorem, which he called semi-classical general relativity. Semi-classical general relativity works on the presumption that the quantum space-time fluctuations are not very frothy. Bottom line, we got observations that tell us that his model holds and the Sean Carroll model doesn't. I got to share this with this guy on the airplane yesterday, late last night on my way home. And he said, that's exactly what I need to talk to these people that are just basically bashing me over the head with Sean Carroll's quantum eternity theorem. I'm not even sure if Sean Carroll is aware of these observations or what it means for his model. I do know that Sean has some bad experiences with Christians, and probably his rejection of Christianity is more personal and psychological than it is about theoretical physics. But, you know, that's often the way it is. They push the theoretical physics as a way to screen what's really going on. I don't know the details, and I'm speculating. I mean, he's free to speculate. I'm free to speculate. Okay. Yes.
A blazar is what?
A blazar. Okay, what's a blazar? I mean, that's what astronomers do. Every time they find something weird, they put an AR on a pulsar, blazar, quasar, spinar. I mean, you got it. Yeah, and a blazar is like a quasar, but with an exceptionally really large black hole that's driving the quasar phenomena. I mean, for example, when I was a graduate student, we were finding all these quasars, but we didn't really know what made them so incredibly bright. And there was speculation about, you know, maybe they're just really small objects. We now know that every quasar sits in the nucleus of a galaxy, because now we've got telescope images can actually see the galaxy that's around the quasar. The quasar is by far the brightest. So what we now realize is what makes the quasar a quasar is the fact that it sits in a supergiant galaxy that's relatively young, aggressive star formation, and there's a pouring of a lot of gas into the nucleus of the galaxy. And, you know, the density of a galaxy is greatest in its nucleus, sufficiently dense that you're going to get stars that will merge together. And as they merge, they become black holes. And the really big galaxies, that merging of stars can actually make really big black holes. Now, in our Milky Way galaxy, its supermassive black hole weighs maybe like 3 million times the mass of the Sun. We're actually finding galaxies where the supermassive black hole comes in at 9 billion times the mass of the Sun. So, and If you've got a distant galaxy where there's huge amounts of gas being poured into the black hole, because that's what happens. As the black hole sucks gas, it converts the matter in that gas into energy with 10% efficiency. So that's the most efficient thing that we observe anywhere in the universe in terms of conversion of matter into energy. To give you a point of comparison, when the sun burns hydrogen into helium, the conversion rate is 0.07%. So we're looking at something that's more than 100 times as intense. And a blazar is basically a quasar that's got a really, really big supermassive black hole with strong magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields give weird energy effects. So that's a blazar.
Does a quasar have the black hole?
All quasars have supergiant black holes. A blazar is basically a spectacular quasar, okay? Put it that way. Yes.
In the same way in that you were saying that Sean Carroll and similar scientists are trying their best to run away from the beginning of space-time, do you see that happening with the double-slit experiment and the Copenhagen interpretation? Is that also a similar phenomenon where you're seeing a movement against?
Well, that's the next chapter I'm going to be working on in the fourth edition, kind of giving an update to the chapter I wrote on quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle. And yeah, where a lot of atheists have gone is thinking that what's happening in the Heisenberg uncertainty is not that causality is hidden from human view, but that we humans are responsible for the causality. And so it's basically using quantum mechanics to put godlike characteristics upon human beings. I mean, the first famous physicist to do this was Niels Bohr. And he says, yeah, what's really going on is our powers of human observation are responsible for the quantum outcomes. But traditional quantum mechanics, which Heisenberg put out, says, no, that's not what's going on. Actually, what quantum mechanics tells us that we humans are weaker than we thought we were. Because if everything's deterministic, you know, we can kind of manipulate things. And what quantum mechanics is saying, there's a realm where we have no idea what's going on. It's hidden from view. And you're actually more impotent than you thought you were. And that's kind of the model I hold to, and it's the model that's consistent with all of our observations. But because of Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you can get really weird things happening, like the double slit experiment, like Schrodinger's cat, where a particle appears to be in two places simultaneously. Those are all outcomes of the Heisenberg uncertainty. Heisenberg uncertainty says causality is so hidden from you that you can get all kinds of possibilities. But that's the word. They're possibilities. Now you say, well, why would the God of the universe make things so improbable? Because that's crucial to get physical life. For example, if it wasn't for the quantum uncertainty being exactly the value that it is, proteins in your body would not be able to function and you would die. All life, including bacteria, need transistors in their proteins in order to function. And the transistors require a quantum uncertainty. Yeah, go ahead.
Was Niels Bohr the one who invented Niels Bohrum?
No. As far as I know, he had nothing to do with the invention of Niels Bohrum. But thank you. We need a little bit of levity here in the class. Yes?
This is a weird question, but does life, when we're looking for life as we know it, is life as we know it the only way that life could be? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do.
Like, could there be something that's living that is so different than what we would expect that we wouldn't know it if we were seeing it? You know?
Well, here's the quick answer. The quick answer is no. Okay, this was a major debate 40, 45 years ago. Is it possible that there could be exotic physical life somewhere else in the universe? And the bottom line is, if it's alive, it's got to be carbon-based. They've tried every element in the periodic table. We now realize by a long measure, carbon is the only game in town. It's the only element that gives you the bonding complexity that life needs and the bonding stability that life needs.
So it would have to be life as we know it.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, carbon-based life. And see, all the fine-tuning arguments only assume that the life is carbon-based. We don't care how many eyes it's got. We don't care how many arms it's got. Carbon-based basically is a very significant factor in determining what life must be like. So the element that came closest was arsenic, but arsenic is not stable enough for life to live more than a few seconds. Yes?
To build on that question, how would you address some of the more avant-garde neuroscientists like Christoph Koch now and Tononi, who are saying, actually, we're going towards panpsychism, saying that, well, what's so special about atoms in our gray matter? Why can't atoms in that microphone also give rise to life and consciousness? I know it sounds bizarre, but Christoph Koch is an neuroscientist. He's the neuroscientist. He's saying, well, I mean, maybe your iPhone knows what it's like to be an iPhone. You know, how would you address?
Well, I had another conversation in the airport. This is the last one I'm going to talk about because I'm already trying to get to some content here. But somebody asked me a question about artificial intelligence in the airport because they were overhearing the conversation. So, hey, can I ask you about artificial intelligence? And I gave them that famous quote that comes out of MIT. We're 10 years away from making an artificially intelligent machine and always will be. And what they're discovering is, yes, we can make machines that can do a lot of the intellectual grunt work that takes so much time for us as human beings to do, but we're never going to make a conscious machine. Consciousness is beyond the capacity of hardware.
How about blending biological with artificial intelligence?
Well, a book recommended years ago was by the British physicist Roger Penrose, and he says, in trying to determine the mind, the brain is basically hardware. The neurons in the brain do not explain the software. And he says, even if we were able to come up with some way to explain the software, for sure we can't explain the programmer. And he says, if you look at the mind, there's a programmer, there's software, and there's hardware. And all we physicists can figure out is the hardware part. Now, there is a quest going on in artificial intelligence. Can we make a computer that's as small and as efficient as the human brain? Because the computers we have today still are not up to the capability in terms of just the pure hardware functions of the human brain. But there is attempts to try to use DNA as a storage device. I mean, you can take a thimble full of DNA and you can store all the data that mankind has produced in that thimbleful of used DNA. So yeah, there's actually a quest. And see, that's realistic. There is the possibility that we might be able to use, quote, the hardware of neurons and the DNA to do the hardware functions of a computer. And you can actually write software that will write software. I mean, how many of you ever use Google Translate? I use it all the time, because I'm asking questions from people all over the world. And what I've noticed is that the Google Translate I use today is way better than the Google Translate 3 years ago. Why? Because the software engineers at Google basically program Google Translate to learn. And so what happens, because so many people use Google Translate, the software is designed that when there's a big uh-oh on the translation, it picks up on that and says, okay, this has happened 3,000 times. That's a poor translation. We're going to stop doing that. And we're going to do this instead. So you can actually write software that allows a machine to, quote, self-learn to a limited degree. As long as you've got lots of lines of codes, that can be done.
How does it know it's wrong?
Because people feedback. Okay. In other words, Google is kind of monitoring the translations and saying, you know what? Hugh Ross had to ask several different questions before he figured out what this guy in Ukraine really wanted to communicate to him. And so if they see like 8 back and forths, okay, that tells the computer, the software, that was a poor translation. And then where there is a clean translation where people get it right away, it's like, okay, that's a good translation. We're going to use that again and again and again. And so that explains why after 3 years, Google Translate is so much better than it was before, because basically it's figuring out, okay, that was an idiom, it doesn't translate well. I mean, to give a classic example, you've got a computer translating between someone in Japanese and someone in English, and the person in English says, a toast to your wife. And it comes across the other side, a piece of burnt bread for your wife. So, but this software is designed to figure, okay, his wife was offended by being, so they kind of figures it out. But for example, it's made communication much more efficient on the internet because the computer actually is figuring this out. However, it's not conscious. It's simply been programmed to learn from its mistakes. And that's how they're able to build a computer that can beat the world's best chess players. Basically, it didn't to start off with, but basically the computer learned from its mistakes and corrected the mistakes and made sure that never happened again. The problem with us human beings, we make a mistake and we repeat the mistake because we don't have good storage devices like that. So, yes.
All the bumping into things, and pretty soon it got out of there because it recorded enough bumps to know not to do that again.
Well, if you've got sufficient funds, you can buy, and you can get this right now, you can buy a vacuum cleaner for your home.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a computer in it. And the first time the vacuum cleaner runs through your, it's a total robot. Yeah, you don't have to do anything with it. But the robot teaches itself where all the furniture is and where it needs to change the suction, etc. And after a few months, as long as you don't move furniture around, it can do a really good job of cleaning your home. So if you move the furniture, it's going to be a couple more months before it figures it out. You can move furniture, but it's going to be a while before the robot vacuum cleaner figures it out. Hey, let me go back to the story of this fellow who's beside me. Okay.
No more questions or comments.
All right. Okay. Got it. Well, he was asking me questions about Sean Carroll and quantum gravity and all this, and then he said, do you think we're ever going to get to the point where we're going to be able to convince all the Sean Carrolls of the world? And I says, no. There's always going to be something we don't understand that Sean Carroll can appeal to and say, that's where I can get rid of God. But it says, what these new discoveries tell us, he says, he thought he had a really good loophole, but we learn more. And as we learn more, it kind of made his loophole a little tinier. Now, in this case, it got rid of it, but I'm sure he's going to come up with something else. And so I told him about the article I had written a few months ago where I made the point that if we apply the methodology of these atheists using the same methodology, I could actually claim that my wife of 39 years does not exist. Okay, because I could keep appealing to that part of my wife I don't know. And so what I wrote in this paper is, you know, it's possible there's exotic physics operating in a realm of the universe we have no access to in terms of time and space, and maybe there's some exotic holograph there, and really I've been engaging a holograph after all these years and not a real physical being. Can I rule that out? Here's how I can rule that out. I can choose to do more observations and experiments on my wife than I've been able to do so far in a different context. And if that reveals that it really looks like she's not a hologram, but is a real person, then that's evidence that, hey, she really does exist. But can I ever get to the point where I get absolute certainty that my wife exists? The answer is no. I could never get to absolute certainty. Likewise, and this is a game a lot of atheist physicists play. They say, I will not believe in your Jesus Christ God of the Bible until you can eliminate all the loopholes. Well, we human beings will never learn everything there is to know about the universe. There will always be a loophole. But here's how you know their line of reasoning is irrational. The more we learn, the greater the evidence accumulates that there is a creator God beyond space and time that created everything. So what I shared with you a few minutes ago is simply a demonstration. Here's where we're able to push back the frontiers of knowledge. And which direction did it go? Did it favor the atheists or did it favor the theists? It certainly favored the theist, and it always has. There's never been a violation to that rule, which would lead me to believe God really does exist. There is a creator beyond space and time. And if I'm honest, I use the same methodology to determine whether or not my wife exists. The evidence gets stronger and stronger as I continue to make observations and experiments. Same thing with God. So, well, turns out, because I looked at this guy and he was really clean cut. So I'm thinking, you know, he's going from graduate school, and it's at Arizona, and it's Northern Arizona State, because you told me he was at Kitt Peak. So this is not the best of the Arizona universities, and he's going straight into a professorship. I said, could it be that he's a Mormon? Because I was thinking, and sure enough, he's going on to take a professorship at Brigham Young University. Okay. But then he got really intrigued because I made the comment, you know, one of the things, because he asked me what I was doing in Texas. So is that the University of Texas, where I was answering the question, how do you go from a scientific demonstration of deism to theism to Christianity by only using science? And I said, well, I told the audience there's three ways that can be done. There's probably more, but three that I can share with you briefly. And he said, well, give me the briefest one. And, you know, it was perfect because he says, well, the briefest one is that the Trinity only makes sense, or science only makes sense if God is triune. You know, Mormons don't believe in the Trinity. So, but he said, I want to hear that one. So I laid it out for him, and he says, that's exactly right. And he says, have you ever spoken at Brigham Young University? And I said, well, about a decade ago, I got a call from the chairman of the physics department, and he wanted me to come and speak on fine-tuning design in the universe. And I said, well, how do the other physicists feel? So I talked to them. They all want you to come. And I said, well, great. I'll be happy to do it. But do you think you're going to be able to get it past the theologians? He says, you don't actually think that we in the physics department believe that the Book of Mormon is true, do you? So he says, we all know that that's not physically possible. So, and I said, well, do the theologians know that? And I said, well, we don't know. They said, you know, there'll be no problem. We'll get you to come. Well, sure enough, the theologian said, it's not going to happen. So it didn't happen. So I shared that with this young man beside me, and he says, I think I can make it happen. So that tells me he's got some clout somewhere. Because, you know, here he is going into this assistant professorship just like that. He's got to have some clout. But, maybe young, I don't know. I didn't ask. But he said, you know, we at Brigham Young need to hear what you got to say. We really need to hear what you got to say about science only making sense of God as triune. I mean, he was very receptive. And, you know, basically said, you know, we've had Muslims come on our campus and speak. We got to have you. He says, I'm going to make it happen. So we'll see. He gave me his card. He's got my card. We'll see what happens. So, you know, what's the probability that I would wind up speaking to, you know, these three academics, actually four academics, on my flight home after I've been speaking for 12 days? And
they didn't know who you were, right?
They had no idea who I was. No, they didn't. No, nobody recognized me. And I share this with you because I've talked to you about this in the class before, 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready with good reasons for the hope within you, and share them with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And your reasons will be very different than my reasons. But whatever reasons you prepare, God will bring people to you that will respond to those reasons. I mean, you know, it's something that I've commented before here, is, you know, here we got Dave. He comes from a Mormon background. And Dave, I think you can remember, and we would do door-to-door evangelism. And I'd send you out, and I would go out, you would talk to ex-Mormons, I would talk to engineers and scientists. Do you think God was kind of putting together the meetings? And likewise, I got to see that happening late last night, that everybody I seemed to talk to seemed to be, and you know, what is the probability that I would be sitting beside somebody who had these deep questions on Sean Carroll and quantum gravity, and I happen to have just written the very latest stuff on the observations that deal with that? So, because that was his comment, he says, there's probably nobody else that could have given me the answer I needed. And, you know, it might have been a couple of other people, but yeah, the probability is very tiny. God's in control. And I'm writing a book on this right now, basically saying, if you'll prepare good reasons, you'll see God performing miracles, and it'll happen to you on a regular basis. The workers are few. God's in the business of putting the right people together at the right time. And so, and the first few times it happens to you, you'll think it's a coincidence. But when it happens to you a few hundred times, you realize this is the Holy Spirit work, making sure that people are prepared or put together with people that are ready to give them the answers that they need. I mean, one thing my wife has told me, said, whenever anybody asks you to look after their luggage, something's going to happen. And she's right. Every time somebody's asked me to look after their luggage or their kids, something has happened. So with that, I'm going to pray, and we'll get to the lesson next week. Am I on the road next week?
No, Easter.
Okay. Yeah, I got a lot of travel coming up, so I'm glad I got people here who are very gifted at leading the class in my absence. But I think I am here 2 weeks from today. Father in heaven, Lord, you've given us a mission, and Father, I pray you make us receptive to the mission. Help us to listen to your Holy Spirit. We can see the opportunities you're presenting before us. And Lord, I pray too that when we run into people, ask us questions where we do not have the answers, it'll help us to prepare good reasons the next time that happens. So Lord, I pray that you make us a team, that we'd help one another to be prepared. And Lord, we all have a story of how you've impacted us. Father, I pray that you put us together with people who can respond to that story. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.